Okay, today is the last day of October. The year is flying by, October 31st, 2011. And once again, I say now good morning to all my students in front of me and the many, many students across the vast world that the Ribbono Shel Olam created. We were just talking about Reb Yitzchak Blaser in the 1860s, how he left the rabbinate. It was already in the 1870s. He had been rabbi for 16 years. I think it was 1878. He had been rabbi for 16 years in St. Petersburg. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's greatest Talmud as far as being a London, the pre-Yitzchak. And when he was forced to get the Gittin in the church from the Mishumadim, he left the rabbinate and he went in, he ran an inn. It's a famous story. Later, I don't want to go into more detail, it would take the rest of the hour and a half. Anyway, this past summer, I'm sitting in a restaurant in Borough Park with the Talmud and his family, and the children of this Talmud wanted to meet me, whatever they, you know, until this past year, I was just the name his father mentioned, but they studied here in Israel for the year, and they heard the name Rakefet, so they wanted to meet me in person. Fine. And we're sitting in this restaurant, if you know Borough Park, right off McDonald Avenue, a Milchika restaurant. And this Borough Park looking couple is staring at me and staring at me. And I look at them and I say, you know, I'm used to people staring at me. In general, I recognize it was a Talmud da. I can't place them. Finally, they come over to me and say, are you Harav Rakefet? I say, yes, I'm Aaron Rakefet. Oh, and the man starts telling me, my wife, and this lady standing next to him, is the first daughter, I think he told me, after seven sons, son after son after son, from Reb Yitzchak Blaser. And the man tells me he was listening to my shiur of the history of Torah in modern times on the YU website, which I gave him my Monday class years ago, and he couldn't. He heard the lecture I devoted the face 3 hours for Yitzchak Blaser. He downloaded it for his father-in-law, and his father-in-law was ecstatic. His father was a Blaser, and he thanked me. I said, so how did you recognize me? He said, from your picture on the YU website. Gentlemen, any relationship between that picture and yours truly is purely coincidental. Okay. Coming back here, I want to make one correction and one slight addendum. The correction was something we discussed in class after the class a few weeks ago, and I got thrown with that curveball on Mayor Berlin and the Rabbinate in Tel Aviv. My mind suddenly was shut down or derailed. And if you remember, we was talking about when the Rosh Yeshiva of Telz died, I mentioned to you that Din Zar, remember I was speaking about the Rabbi Gifter book, and I mentioned that Din Zar, Rav Shmuel Zar, eulogized his Rebbe in London, because the Telz Rosh Yeshiva died in London collecting funds. Anyway, I mentioned two names. I juxtaposition the father and the son-in-law. The person who died in London was the founder of Telz, Reb Blazer Gordon. If you recall, I said in Shir, Reb Blazer Bloch, Reb Avram Yitzchak Bloch was his son-in-law, but Reb Blazer Gordon was the one who died 1910, and Shmuel Zah found himself in Telz, and he eulogized his Rebbe. Found himself in London and he eulogized his Rebbe, and Reb Blazer Gordon is buried in London, and I'm told there's a nohel on top of his grave. Yesterday, I mentioned that every time they gave a drasha in Chazal in public, there was a meturgeman standing over him and explaining his words. The term that Chazal used for the meturgeman is amora. And in my mind yesterday, I had the term Amora, but I didn't want to say it because I thought maybe there's a more sophisticated term. And it's Amora, and I'm holding in front of me a Xerox from my colleague, Rabbi Yitzchak Frank, for his Aramaic Talmudic dictionary with the words in English. So With Amora, this term was applied in Talmudic times to a man who stood near the Chacham while the latter was delivering his lecture and repeated what the Chacham said to the audience in a loud voice. Occasionally, the Amora also explained some of the points mentioned in the Chacham's lecture and translated some Hebrew words in Aramaic, the language which was more widely understood at that time. So I give credit to Yitzchak Frank, Rabbi Frank, did a beautiful job in that Talmudic dictionary. And now let us roll. So what did we speak about last week? We spoke about last week how many of the ideas of the Mizrahi have come into the mainstream, and I even saw there was a debate. Again, I don't want to roll the scuttle, but it's not important. But we're always going to have morons in this world. Klal gadul amru b'Torah. That's why I personally don't get upset if there's a moron or two who says something stupid. There are always going to be people. I just saw today on a website that some woman did a doctorate, that the Talmud only gained authority because of Rashi. Until Rashi, the Talmud was not authoritative. I mean, it's beyond words how people can come up with theories, nishkishtegin, nishkiflegin, if you know Yiddish. It's beyond words. But nevertheless, this is the world. So there was a whole debate, I understand, on Israeli television between some Professor Habakkuk. Again, all the 90% of the morons in the world come from the United States. It's amazing. It's amazing what the U.S. has turned out. So this Habakkuk is a professor of law, and he's very close to Rabbi Yashuv, and he's Mamash Yisakma, and he's debating with, I think it was Rabbi Eichler, my good at Yisrael. And Rabbi Eichler already sounds like Rakefet, and Habakkuk is literally a Satma. We should separate the church and religion, have nothing to do with it. Don't give a hoot about all the other Jews, just he's going to a ghetto, it's out in Namshiva Shalom al Yisrael. And Rabbi Eichler says, I couldn't believe my ears, what are you blaming Agudah? It's Mizrahi that invoked all the legislation in Israel. We haven't done a thing about religious legislation. We don't believe in it today. It's not we don't believe in it, we don't need it today. And Ein Hachinami is the greatest compliment you can pay to Mizrahi. As I explained last week, that the army is an army that is a Jewish army. Everyone can serve in it. We spoke last week about the chinuch, about the rabbinate, about kiddin v'kiddushin. But there's no question we've paid a price because it's a democracy and you're coercing people. But nevertheless, when people challenge me in debate, in dialogue, in discussion, how can you coerce Rakefet? You were raised in America, you believed in democracy, you went to Russia, you saw communist Russia, you came back and kissed the ground of Israel because it's Israel and because it's a democracy. It's all correct. But we're a Jewish state. And we struggle with this. And I have to give Aaron Barak, I'm no great fan of the former head of the Supreme Court, happens to live around the corner from me, and on a personal level, he's a very nice person, and Amoritz, not only the Oraita to the 50th power. A trim, oh, wow, it's just beyond words how someone can be so brilliant and know so little about Yiddishkeit. But that's the way he was raised. And he, when he dealt with the question of importing treif meat, and the Supreme Court upheld the decision of those in charge of importing meat that they could only import kosher meat. So right away, it's against democracy. How do you limit? Why only kosher meat? Why can't you import pork sausages, etc., etc.? And he said very clearly that we're both a Jewish state and a democracy. And at times, the democratic value has to give way to the Jewish value. Of course, at times, it's the opposite. To give you a simple example, can we outlaw driving on Shabbos? Do we want to outlaw driving on Shabbos? I don't know. I have very mixed emotions. I walk in the street and I see cars speeding by, driven by Jews. It troubles me. On the other hand, it's a personal matter, it's democracy, it's freedom. If you were to outlaw it, you'd cause bitterness. Two-thirds of them would run away to South Africa, to Australia, to Canada. Those are countries you can get into fairly easily. Some would get into America. No, you want them to leave Israel? ultimately, some of their children, their grandchildren, will come back, l'kavod u'l'tiferet. But this is an ongoing tension. And then I went into a whole discourse on the tyranny of democracy, quoting de Tocqueville, and that, of course, deals with the Shalit case, and that's a very real problem. In other words, the masses can always be manipulated. Generally speaking, the masses have no deep commitment. Most people just think what's here, what's now. All of you know that the election in the United States, one factor will determine it, the economic factor. Everything else becomes secondary. Now, why is the economic factor so important? Because people feel their pocketbook every day. Right or wrong, you've all learned Bava Metzia. A person feels his money, and it's a lot deeper than just feeling that you have your money. We live, we have to make cheshbonot, we have to live within a budget. And this is democracy, and you can manipulate the public. And the example of Gilad Shalit is a brilliant example how the family utilize such strategies, the advisors. I mean, you have to know who was behind them. And this was done pro bono. And I'm not being critical, but I'm calling your attention to what de Tocqueville already understood in the 1850s when he visited America. There is liberalism in democracy, there's respect for the individual, but there's a tyranny in democracy. And you see that in the United States with the homosexual marriages. The first Sunday I was in New York, it was like people were dancing in the streets. Any Jew, any liberal, anyone who went to college, anyone who had a PhD, the New York Times, the governor, the mayor is of Jewish origins, the governor's of Catholic origins, and Cuomo just came out now that he's going to fight that in every state in America, homosexuals should be allowed to marry. And they now say the percentage of people requesting licenses in City Hall, they say 30% are same-sex marriages. God have mercy. So that's tyranny of democracy. Now, these are problems. You can't solve them overnight. As I said last week, this is the greatness of Malchut Beit David, that a king cares that he has a kingdom to give his child. No president thinks beyond the next election. No prime minister, Netanyahu, Sharon, whoever was prime minister, no one thinks beyond the next election. Barack probably figured out he doesn't have a chance to be reelected, so he went for broke while he's now in power. And defense minister formed his own party, left, does what he wants. This is a politician. But a king has to think, what will I give my child, my grandchild, 25 years, 50 years, 100 years from now. David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Chaim. This is Malchut, but Malchut has to be Al Pi Torah, a king who's observing in the Torah, Mishnah Torah, etc. Okay, now, the Mizrahi succeeded, so it brought itself off the map, but I want to add one thought and add on one other thought that will make Michael happy. You want the proof that I'm right? When did Mizrahi start disappearing? The day that Begin came to power in 1977. Yosef Burg, who I knew intimately, you've heard the name Rabbi Dr. Joseph Burg, was of German origins, he yet knew the Rav from Berlin. He was a genius. There's no two ways. I mean, I am an ear witness, eyewitness. I was standing around him. There were about 20 of us standing around him in Heichal Shlomo after some affair. And he looked at each one and spoke to you. This is in one conversation. He looked at me, he spoke English. The guy next to me, he spoke French. The next person, he spoke Italian. The fourth guy, he spoke Spanish. The next guy, he spoke Yiddish. The seventh guy, he spoke Hebrew. The eighth guy, he went to German. Each one, you know, I couldn't believe my ears. And I once called him to interview him for my work on the Rav. I quote him, I believe, in a footnote on the Rav in Berlin. So I say, Dr. Burg, Aaron Rakefet Medaber, immediately breaks into English, you're not Aaron Rakefet, you're Aaron Rothkopf. I mean, I couldn't believe my ears. And Burg said so insightfully, he was a long-serving Mizrahi member of Knesset, member of the government. Burg said very insightfully, every time Menachem Begin says Baruch Hashem, the Maftal, the religious Zionist party, loses. 5,000 votes. And boy, did he hit the nail on the head. And you just think about that. And from that point on, religion entered the mainstream, and you'll see it with Agudat Yisrael. Now, I also want to add another point. The reason Mizrahi is not a force politically today, there's another reason too, and that is Shas. Shas comes along, we'll talk about it. It's not an offshoot of Mizrahi, it's an offshoot of Agudat Yisrael. But you see, Shas, it's not so much a religious party. It took me a long time to understand this. I mean, I used to get upset with sometimes they had representatives that they literally spoke Reform Judaism. They would have beards and dress black and literally a mayoritz d'oraita and no understanding of what Torah is about. But it's an ethnic party. And what Shas did, it pulled out of the Mizrahi a great deal of the Sephardic voters who would have voted Mizrahi, became very prominent and very happy and very at ease, very at home in Shas. And if you go to Bukharin, although Rav Avadya now lectures, I understand, over, I don't know what to call it, cable TV, call it what you wish, you give me the exact term, you're the expert, I'm not. You know, he speaks from his home, but the thousands sitting in Bukharin see him on the screen. A direct broadcast, what would you call it? Live broadcast, live internet, I don't know. And Rav Avadya, this Saturday night, he went after the Chilonim and he said, nothing bad, I have to tell you, I agree with him 100%. But the secular press already was clapping their hands. They caught Rav Avadya. He said, you know, that you have to tell the Sfadim, you have to do outreach, you have to reach out. Why is it so important? Because if you make one person from Kol HaMatzil Nefesh Achas B'Yisrael Matzil Olam Mole, his kids, his grandchildren knew, what's so wrong with that? He says, get them into a chinuch Torani. Here they have no chinuch. You know, the secularists feel challenged. It's like saying they have no values. They do have, I always used to say in the army, they do have values, but their values are universal. They're not uniquely Jewish. To be a good person, a fine person, an ethical person, a moral person, that's very nice. And it's very important. And it's part of Torah. It's half of Torah. The Aseret HaDibrot divide in half. But it doesn't make you a proper Jew. Okay, you have to add to it. So Rabbi Avadya speaks, when you look at the audience, there are endless kiputz rugot in the audience. So you see, Shas as an ethnic party, giving the Sfadim pride, giving them a say in the government. And remember, for the last 20 years, no government could do anything without Shas's acquiescence. They are a very powerful force. So this too cut away from Avdal's support to the nth degree. And now you see, of course, Maftal no longer exists, but the concept, Ribbono Shel Olam, who could believe, and we'll see this with Agudat Yisrael, that 90% of Shomer Shabbos Jews live with the principles of Maftal, basically, of the original Mizrahi of 1902. Yes, Yitzchak?
I think another factor is the whole problem of the settlements.
No, I understand, I understand.
All the people who are religious within the Maftal, who felt that the Maftal had turned to the right in supporting the settlements, they broke away, they started Mimad, and they started other things.
Well, which didn't succeed. All these parties didn't succeed, but to those, the rank and file of Maftal, today what's a burning issue for them is not the settlements, it's Eretz Yisrael. Why do you call settlements? Call it Eretz Yisrael. That the old leaders cannot be trusted, and they've moved very much to the right on this particular issue, feeling the need on this issue to have their own party. But okay, this is debatable whether it was wise, not wise, but the reality, there's no question, 80% of what I've said is correct. Maftal is the mainstream, and we'll see that with Agudat Yisrael. Yeah.
What about two major disclosures that came out about Maftal over the years? Number one, Michael Oren's book and how they were opposed to taking Yerushalayim, certainly against taking the Golan. And second, their failure to influence the educational system in this country, even though they were Minister of Education for years.
No. One second. Let's go schlaf, schlaf. But very quickly, because once you get involved in politics, each one interprets it differently. There's no question that the original Mizrahi movement had a very, what we would call in today's language, a dovish streak. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I spoke about it in class or not, but Rabbi Reines was in favor of Uganda. And they viewed saving Jewish lives as the epic achievement, and it doesn't matter where. And if we can save them by going to Uganda, they were in favor of Uganda. There was a bitter split within the Zionist movement in general and within the Mizrahi people. So that this concept of what you would call dovishness today, not going to battle, the Six-Day War, not taking Yerushalayim, not taking the Golan Heights, this is Maftal true to historic form. What happened after the Six-Day War leads to what Yitzchak just referred to. There was a sea change. The world changed. To go into it a little deeper, Vayakum da Chadash, it's a generation raised in Israel. Their values are different, their understandings are different, their commitments are different. And of course, you have to go back to Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. It's almost prophetic, but I lived it. I know it to be true. I had a recording. I may still have that recording. Do you know that Merkaz HaRav, Mincha, someone had to walk out of the yeshiva, stand on the street, at center, they didn't have a minion for Mincha on Wednesday, Thursday, Tuesday, Monday afternoon, Sunday. Understand? That's how small the yeshiva was. Yom Atzmaut, 1967, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, of course, was the featured speaker at the Sudat Mitzvah at Merkaz HaRav, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda, in the middle of the talk, breaks down and cries and says, Loma nachnu kol kach smechim, ham yesh lanu eretz Yisrael ha'amitit, a full Beit Lechem, a full Chevron. This is Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook speaking and crying. And of course, 5 weeks later, 6 weeks later, he was davening at the Kotel HaMaravi, and that raised a whole generation, among them Rabbi Benny Eisner, whom I eulogized yesterday, Zeicher Tzadik Levracha, we just lost a tremendous machaneich, raised a whole generation. It caused the sea change. The rest is history. So that today, when Maftal tried to go back to his historic stance, and Rav Amital after the Yom Kippur War, and I don't fault Rav Amital, he buried many students, to bury students, is not easy. To bury students who die in battle, I believe it was 8 Alon Shvat boys died in the Yom Kippur War, among them students I knew, and Rav Amital shifted gears. He had been very messianic, and now he changed. And of course, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein with his approach, and as much as they tried, they have not entered the mainstream of the so-called Mizrahi thinking today, to use a popular term. And today, already, it's a new generation, a different generation. It's a Mizrahi that is born and bred in Israel, not born and bred in Eastern Europe. You understand? So, Baruch Hashem, these problems are universal problems for the state of Israel. It's not just for religious Jews, Eretz Yisrael Hashlema, compromise, Western pressure, the UN, the United States. All I can tell you is some Saudi prince just offered, what was the sum, $100,000 or my... $900,000 already, that to kidnap another Israeli soldier. And we stand by, and then we should, the UN should throw them out, the UN, Iran, what are we dealing with? Okay, I'm a right winger, and I stand on it. Gentlemen, the world of Agudat Yisrael. What a world, what a story. What success, and what theological failure. I tell you in advance, I will be as honest as I possibly can. I hope that Agudat Yisrael will do what Satna did for me, write me up as an Agudist. When one studies Torah history, we have to be honest. I have to take my own hashkafer out of it. I just got a big compliment, came to my ears last night, that someone taking a course at Touro heard one of the professors say, the only person who writes about the Rav honestly is Harav Rakefet. Everyone else pulls him left and pulls him right, and Harav Rakefet describes him as he was. So he's echoing Rabban Lichtenstein, I understand Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So Baruch Hashem, he's in good company, and I'm in better company. Gentlemen, how did Agudat Yisrael begin? Who heard of Agudat Yisrael? Just think for a moment, Morty, when you walked around in 1880 and 1890, in 1900, did you hear of Agudat Yisrael? Absolutely not. Didn't exist. But you see, our Rebbeim, when I went to Yeshiva Salanta, and I allude to this in my book, it's our Rebbeim, you know, the Europeisha used to put us down, Europe, wonderful, everyone good, from, nice, and you know, and I felt like a dog. I live in America, I've gotten so many thank yous on my new book from people, Rebbe, what you did for us, my children could not understand the way I was raised, what it was like to be the only from kid in Staten Island. Thank God, I'm reading to them about your growing up in the Bronx. Okay, Europe, wonderful, good. Yeah, Mir, probably little hamlets like Mir, I don't want to question my Rebbeim. Yes, I write in my book, and my Rebbe, Reb Chanuch Fishman, told me that on Wednesday night there were as many people in shul to daven Marv as there are on Leil Kol Nidre. Believe me, I didn't believe my Rebbe, and I apologize, Rebbe. Not nice that a Talmud shouldn't believe his Rebbe. But in Yerushalayim, I saw he was right. There is many people davening Marv in the Shtiblach in Katamon on a Wednesday night as there are davening Kol Nidre night. My Rebbe was right. But that was Mir. That was a little hamlet, a little shtetl. By 1900, the Enlightenment had crossed the border. Remember, it took time. It's not like today. You turn on your computer and the whole world is at your fingertips. Not like today. It took hundreds, took tens and tens and tens of generations. But the Enlightenment. Now, the Enlightenment in Eastern Europe took on a much more positive tinge than Western Europe. Western Europe, as I've told you so many times, Moshe Mendelssohn did not have one great-grandchild who died Jewish. Not one. He had one grandson who was buried Jewish, not one great-grandchild. Intermarriage, assimilation, Reformed Judaism. In Eastern Europe, it led to, on a positive level, Zionism, rebirth of Hebrew. On a more universal level, socialism, Bundism. The Bund was the Jewish socialist movement, ultimately communism, Bolshevikism, saving the world, workers of the world unite, communism, Lenin. I mean, we now find out he had Jewish blood in him. Lenin's ideals, fabulous. If you didn't believe in communism as a young man, someone your age who didn't believe in communism at the turn of the last century was not young. And if you still believed in communism when you were in, you know, saw what the hell happened to it, you were an idiot. But when you were young, you had to believe, and I don't want to mention names of Gedolei Yisrael, who I was told were had communist leanings in their youth. You all know that Rabbi Revel, whom I wrote about there, it's not a secret, he was arrested in 1905 in Kovna for being part of the Bund movement, and the Tsar suspected they were out to overthrow him, correctly so. Now, with all this innovation came a downgrading of religion. You could still be a Bund and be religious, the Bundist and be religious, you could still be a Zionist and be religious, but by and large, the Torah world was falling down. You had something that was unheard of in Eastern Europe. Chilul Shabbat b'Parhesia. Until 1900, you read the memoir literature, even an Apikoros Gamor, they used to tell the famous joke about the Minsk Apikoros, that this kid growing up in a small town suddenly has questions on Tanakh, on Torah Shabbat Peh, and he wants to leave, and he wants to become an Apikoros, and he decides to go to Minsk, to visit with the Minsker Apikoros, he should get Hadrachah from him. comes into Minsk, comes into a shnibble. He says, Avu veint, avu davent, avu kenich kifrinin de Minsk apikores. Oh, the Minsk apikores, go to this in the shul, you'll see him comes into the shul. He comes in, he says, where's the Minsk apikores? They point to this guy sitting in a corner with a talus over his head, with tefillin. And he goes, oh, here's the Minsk apikores? Yeah. Yeah, yes. He said, so what are you davening? You're an apikores. He says, what do you mean? Ich bin an apikores, but ich bin a yid. I'm a Jew. So, you know, even an apikores wasn't Mechalel Shabbos b'Prahesia. Read Batsheva Singer's memoir of his life. It's fascinating. I read it 40 years ago and I thought the guy was a pervert. I hate to tell you this, but 40 years later, after seeing what some of the problems we have in the Torah community, believe me, I reread it. I told my wife I misjudged him. It's not a pervert at all. There were stories like this in his father's court. Father was a chassidisha, a shtigl chassidisha rebbe. So you read his memoir, you'll see what I'm saying. That even an apikores, when he among Jews, he put on tefillin, he was in Machal Shabbos. By 1900, you were Machal Shabbos Beper Hesiga. There was a tremendous breakdown. The women, you've got to remember, again, the liberal world, the feminist world, all this was first crystallizing, and Jewish women went to gymnasium. You all saw Fiddler on the Roof. Fiddler on the Roof is based upon Tevye the Milkman, Shalom Aleichem's story. It's all real. This is what was happening. And yeshiva boys, we have stories from memoir literature of yeshiva boys that were learning around the clock, and they came home for Shabbos to visit their family, and they picked up some, what we would call today, revolutionary literature, communist literature, and within 48 hours, they became total apikorsim and never went back to the yeshiva again. And you all know all the communist ideology. Who does it come from? Who is involved? You take Trotsky, you take Frankl. These were Jews who in their youth were raised from. Many had been yeshiva boys. And you take the Zionism and the secular Zionism and the literature of Friedenberg and Berechevsky. These are the Russian yeshiva boys. It's mind-boggling what happened. You take Chaim Nachum Bialik, and by the way, Bialik was not Machal Shabbos Beper Hesiod. I mean, you have to give credit where you have to give credit. But Bialik is a Volozhin yeshiva boy. He learned in Volozhin at the same time as Rav Kook. You take, we spoke about Asher Ginsberg, Achad Ha'am, a Polish Chassidish Yingel, a Gaon Adir. And look what was happening. There was one Jew. You see, we Jews, we spoke about Lo Tidgodedu yesterday in Shia. I'll come back to it next week. I want to show you the Rambam and the Shop and what we were saying, Lahalacha, because it's going to affect all of next week's Shia. But Lo Tidgodedu is a very interesting concept. What does it mean? Unfortunately, we Jews are totally split. When it comes to thinking, even in this classroom, we have so many different approaches. Is this Lo Tidgodedu, or is it healthy? Is it a reflection of the divine image? Of course, where I come from, and I have to say I'm totally on the same wavelength with Rav Sabato and Rav Lichtenstein. I can't get over that book. It's fabulous and it's intelligible. Rav Sabato brings Rav Aaron down to earth. You follow me, Daniel? Brings him down to earth. I love it. I love it. So, all right, where I come from, thank God we all don't think the same way. All right. But you see, by 1900, you had Chassidim, you had Litvakin, you had German Orthodoxy. Worse than that, they were fighting with each other, maledicting each other. Particularly, look, I saw it with my own eyes. When Chaim Nashman was the only kid in yeshiva in my time. You don't know him today. His name is today Chaim Neiman, I think they pronounce it. He was the only kid in yeshiva. His father was a sheikh, a chassidish yid. I can still see his father in front of my eyes. Chassidish yid in the Bronx, a sheikh, Chaim Nashman, in yeshiva. The only kid with his tzitzit out. The only kid who would kiss the mezuzah. When Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, the Litvak par excellence, saw Chaim kiss the mezuzah, he went ballistic. He opened up a mouth on him that I cannot repeat what Rabbi Gorelick said in public. But you see, we saw the clash. One time I was stupid enough, Rabbi Noach Bornstein, I spoke about him at the Great Synagogue, if you recall. Everyone, Tova couldn't get over what I said with Rabbi Noach and Rabbi Yeruchim. So Rabbi Noach Bornstein, the Brisker Rebbe's top Talmud. No, it winds up in America. I was his Talmud, I was his good friend, we were Bronxites. So I was so stupid. Chabad, this goes back, let's say, 54, 55. Chabad was just building up a rep. The young Rebbe had taken over in 51, and everyone was talking, something big is happening in Crown Heights. So I was a curious kid. I contacted Chabad, they had a youth organization, and they arranged home hospitality, and I was at Lubavitch for Shabbos Mevorchim Rosh Chodesh when the Rebbe had a tish. Every Shabbos Mevorchim Rosh Chodesh, once a month the Rebbe had a tish on Shabbat. I describe it in my book. So I had a fabulous Shabbos. That Shabbos, if you read my book carefully, you'll see how it influenced my hashkafa until today, thank God. And I've influenced, I hope, many others. So I came back from the weekend, and Sunday, like an idiot, I told Rebbe Noach, Rebbe, Chav HaBrach, that's our Shabbos, I had a wonderful Shabbos, and Chav Given, Ban Rebach, Bach HaBad, Ban Rebbe, in Crown Heights. Wow, if I told him I was at a Buddhist temple, he would have been happier. Take my word for it, okay? And I was a kid, I didn't understand yet why the enmity, why the hatred. But the only thing that the Litvakin and the Hasidim shared in common was their enmity towards the German Jews. Oh, did they laugh at the Yekeshit Abanim, you know, with the little Van Dykes, with the beautiful dress, polished buttons, and yet Shabbos they wore robes, what they call it, canicles, if I'm pronouncing it right, right or wrong, they wore robes, their pictures of Rav Shimshon, Rav Ol, Hirsch, it's a miracle, I guess they can't with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, there's a black, he's wearing a brown hat, so there's one version of the picture, they changed the brown hat black, you understand? Mori Urebi, there's a picture of Mori Urebi, Rav Soloveitchik, from in Boston. I don't think it was during the yarmulke, it was at university, it was a university picture. So his great his nephew, Rabbi Yosef, when he reproduced the picture, he put a big yarmulke on him, you understand? So you can do that. But with Rav Hirsch, his whole body is covered by the canonical robes. How do you get rid of it? You can't get rid of it. What are you going to do? Put a kittel on him? How do you take a picture on Yom Kippur? So you see, they laughed at the Yekesh. They had a field day. Okay, gentlemen, in the state of Israel, we're constantly fighting. We're constantly cursing each other. We're constantly maledicting each other. God have mercy on us, what goes on here. But we can get away with it. Why? There are already 2 million Shomer Shabbos Jews. Today in Chinuch, we're successful with the children, minimum 80%. 80% of the kids in the Mamlachti Dati world, in the Tzioni world, in the Aguda world, 80% of the kids remain within the fold. It's not like years ago, 80% of the kids, you were lucky if one child remained from the Lubavitcher Rebbe's family, the only child to remain from was the Rebbe. Are you aware of that or not? Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky's family, the only child to remain from was Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky. Reb Aaron Kotler, I mean, it's mind-boggling what idiots try to cover up. Everyone knew his sister. Malka, I told you stories. I don't need Nassim Kamenetsky in Making of a Gadol. I know the people. I heard from them exactly what happened. When she was ill, she never married. She was a professor. She was in Russia. They finally got her out. They got her to Paris. And then Reb Aaron brought her to America, and she was in a senior citizen's residence. So Reb Aaron asked, it was in Queens, he asked, very chashuv, a Queens Rabbanim, Tuma Teva, go and visit my eldest sister Malka once a month. She should have some company. She, you know, Rachmona Safia, she never married. So Rav Schoenfeld was among those who organized it. So one time he calls my friend Roy Albert, Rabbi Albert Zeichen, Tzadik Lefracha, the photographer, the rabbi. Roy, are you free? I'm going to see Malka Kotler. Come with me. It'll be an experience for you. So they go to visit her. And this is, we're talking now in the late 50s. And who is Rav Aaron Kotler then? The world was shaking because of Rav Aaron. And his sister, Bakluxich, how do you say that? Anyway, help me out with English. She's crying, bemoaning herself. See, Bakluxich, she says, mein Brudarla Vosfakop, what a mind he had. He could have been the greatest, the greatest mathematician in the world, the greatest mathematician. And was his a kleiner Rebbe, a little Rebbe. That's all he is. You understand? This was Malka Kotler speaking. And the chutzpah that Talmidim Rabbanan write up, she was religious, but she was more of a Mizrachiite. Oh, criminal. And this is why, I the more I think about it, the angrier I get that I was willing to bow to what Rav Shlomo Pick told me. You understand? The more I think about it, I want to see the document. When the family releases it, either the rub is right or wrong. Until then, I come down on the side of the rub. Period. Now, when you're losing your children wholesale, you can't afford to fight. Because when a kid sees the fighting, you know, an intelligent kid, look what he says. And this is logical. Chassidim hate the Mitnagdim. The Mitnagdim hate the Chassidim. They both hate the Germans. There are many versions of Yiddishkeit. I'm a Zionist, secular Zionist. I'm a liberal world changer, a Bundist, universal justice, the Ahasta L'Reacha Kamocha, the Mishnah in Bav Metzia. We have to feed the poor of the Gentiles. You see, all this, he went further. And the world was caving in. One Jew winds up in a very central, unique position. His name, Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Rabinovich. If you don't recognize the name, make believe you do, so that the ignorant will pass for the wise. Reb Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Rabinovich, the Dorot HaRishonim. Recognize that? Who was he? What was he? Very fascinating. He was basically a Volozhin Talmud, but a Volozhin Talmud who was very broad. And he got involved in fighting the biblical critics, the historic critics, the histories of the Jews, Gretz, and he wrote a tremendous set, Dorot HaRishonim, which has a lot of lumdus and pilpul in it, writing his history of the Jews in contradistinction, basically, to Gretz and others. So you see right away, he wasn't the average Volozhin yeshiva boy. In addition, he had a Hasidic streak in him. And he went to Rebbeim, he dressed like a Hasid, and above all, where do you think he lived in Germany? Bad Homburg, which was a resort town, a health town near Frankfurt. Bad Homburg. It might have had water springs there, you know, mineral baths. Now, he knew Litha, he knew Chassidus, and he knew German Orthodoxy. All three. And there was a little of each within him. And he lived in Bad Homburg, made a living out of some teaching, out of writing. Bad Homburg, as a resort area, everyone came there. It's like Yam HaMelech. Yam HaMelech today has, I understand, a separate beach Yam HaMelech, that all over Israel today, they're dedicating separate beaches. It's a fabulous, fabulous thing. I know, you're going to tell me the Rebbe went mixed swimming and onset and this and that. You're absolutely right. But that was a different generation. And I once showed pictures in this class of the New York Times 100 years ago, what women looked like in their bathing suits. Gentlemen, women were more modestly dressed at the beaches 100 years ago than they are on the streets of Tel Aviv at this very moment. So don't tell me about years ago. Today you go swimming, what women are wearing? I once was with my wife buying a bathing suit in the Mashbir, when we were little Israel, the little Mashbir. Today it's going to be, I think, tomorrow is the big dedication of the biggest department store in the state of Israel. Ashreinu shezachinu lekach. It's going to be unbelievable, I understand. And what a dedication with jugglers and entertainment and bands, the center of town tomorrow afternoon. Unfortunately, I can't go there. I have to be at my daughter's. But believe me, my spirit will be there. Israel is expanding. Thank God. So I couldn't believe what they're selling, a bikini, one little strip of cloth, and they're charging a fortune. So I asked the sales lady, "Bishvil ma mishalim kan? Ein kan shum davar. There's nothing here." She says to me, "You're paying for the design. And to design one strip of clothes with 2-3 colors, I can do it myself. I don't have to go to Schenker School of Design." So you see, the hot baths, the resort areas, attracted Gedolei Yisrael. We Jews suffer from arthritis. I have my own theory. Goyim do not suffer from arthritis the way Jews do. And I have a simple theory. It's because Goyim drink schnapps every day. And we Jews, on Shabbos, on Rosh Chodesh, now we had a kiddush of the Chatanim in my shul. I drank a shot of scotch. Oh, I got to tell one grandson.
Religious requirement to have the schnapps?
Yeah, what can I tell you? At least we drink once a week, but they drink at every meal, Kanayin Hara. And I've been with Goyim all over the world. You go on airplanes, go on speed trains. They're drinking all the time. It's beyond words. And they don't go to the bathroom. Jews have smaller bladders. Ronan, you're starting your residency tomorrow. How does it work? Am I using the right word, residency?
Yeah,
that's another. You did your internship. Yeah. And this is the residency, the hitmatchot. Find out if it's true. Go through the textbooks. I claim Jews have smaller bladders than Gentiles. And they drink, they don't have, but we Jews never, arthritis, rheumatism, pains. So all the Gedolei Yisrael wound up in Bar Hamburg. Who did they come to visit? They came to visit. Well, you had a gong there. You had Reb Yitzchak, Isaac HaLevi, Rabinovitz. By the way, his direct descendants, whom I know, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they already go with the name HaLevi. The name Rabinovich has been dropped. It's interesting. If you meet HaLevis, there may be a chance that they're direct descendants. So they started to talk. And he started to talk. And they were crying bitterly. Chilul Shabbos becomes more intensified. Number one. Number two. Even the good youth is being drawn away by the Zionist movement, the secular Zionist movement. Who are the leaders? Who's running? Who's in the Zionist movement? Who's advocating Zionism? It's our children. What are we going to do? How are we going to stop the flood? How are we going to stop this massive departing from Judaism? And Reb Yitzchak Isaac HaLevi came up with the idea. He gets the credit, although obviously the idea germinated in discussion. We have to unite. We have to have an organization. In unity, there is strength. Psychologically, this is very important. I'll tell you why. It's the whole idea of conventions. What is NCSY all about? Who came up the ladder through NCSY here? Anybody, okay, Danny, Where were you raised, Denny? What city you were raised?
Denver.
Denver, Colorado. No, Denver, Colorado. How many from Jews do you have? Yeah. All right, you're not Buckle Bashishim, but you're an absolute minority. All the Jews and that big temple there that has a little Orthodox base medrash on the side, the temple, I saw crowds there on Shabbos, the parking lot overflowing. Wow, you feel like an idiot. You became from NCSY, reached out to you. Who am I? What am I? Read Rakepit's book. Have you studied his book, Washington? Believe me, it's better than his 6 books of scholarship. This book has meat, but you have to feel it. You feel echad be'ir. Who are you? But you hold a convention. You hold a convention. Thousands of kids. Wow. I'm part of a movement. It's a force. It's Torah. It's orthodoxy. NCSY. There's unity. We have meetings all year. We have connection. We have literature. We reach out. We inspire. This was the idea. And in 1912 in Katowice, the first conference, every agudist, whenever you read an interview with them, they refer to the Katowice conference. This was the first conference. It's not correct to call it Agudat Yisrael yet. The first conference was for all Orthodox Jews to step forward. We're going to find an organization. We're going to be united. We're going to work together. We're going to propagate the ideal. We're going to show that one can walk with Torah on the modern scene in the year 1912. Why was Katowice chosen? Who knows? Who's been to Europe? Who's been to Katowice? Katowice is on the border, right between Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary. It's accessible from all over. It's an ideal convention center. And Katowice will play a very important role in the history of Agudat Yisrael. Yoni, give me credit. I will get to it much later. But this is the first Katowice. This is a convention, a conference, a meeting to plan a major organization. Now, who came to Katowice? All the great Rashi Yeshiva, Chassidic Rebbeim, the German Rabbanim. Who came and who left quite upset? Reb Chaim Brisker. And here's the inside story. And disregard whatever you read in popular magazines, they write Reb Chaim Brisker, one of the founders of Agudat Yisrael. He was unfortunately dead by the time Agudat Yisrael started to function, number one. Number two, he walked away in anger. Why did he walk away? And I'll give you 2 stories that I heard from the Soloveitchik family. I believe that both are absolutely correct. Number one, this is the anecdotal story. It's fabulous. Heard it from Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, heard it from others in the family. Reb Chaim comes, he's told, all right, he meets fellow Rashi Yeshiva, people he knew of, Yosef Leib Bloch. By the way, Reb Yosef Leib Bloch was the son of Reb Leisa Gordon. Reb Avram Yitzchak was the grandson-in-law. Let me correct myself when I said an hour ago. He reads Reb Yosef Leib Bloch was the Telz Rashi Yeshiva. He reads Reb Moshe Mordechai Epstein was the Slabodka Rashi Yeshiva. These are people he can relate to. He meets the Gera Rebbe and Reb Chaim had a streak of deep appreciation for Hasidus within him. It goes with the Brisker dynasty. Reb Chaim, Reb Velvel, Reb Moshe, Mori Rebbe, had no problem with the Gera Rebbe. He reads Reb Meir Shapiro, later the Lublina Rosh Yeshiva, the Chatkava Chassid, who changed Polish Jewry, and then Hitler destroyed it all. It's totally at home. Rebbe Zalman Meltzer, Kletzka Rosh Yeshiva. he meets them all. At that time, it was still in Slutsk, the Slutsk Rosh Yeshiva. It's no problem. He's used to them. He's accustomed to them. He's at home with them. He has a common language with them. He meets the Yekesher Rabbi. He couldn't take it. So they asked Reb Chaim, why are you so upset? So Chaim answers, telling you what I heard, word by word, from a baron and others in the family. Chaim answers, well, I'll give you an example, a mashal. A lady moves into a new community. She comes to the vegetable store for the first time. And there's a teenage boy working there. And she asked the teenage boy, how much are the carrots? He says, 10 ruble. How much are the peppers? 10 ruble. How much are the potatoes? 10 ruble. She goes over to the guy who owns the store. She says, I don't understand it. Fashtainish. Everything is 10 rubles? He says, lady, of course not. But this young man has a speech defect. All he can say is 10 ruble. Reb Chaim says, I have a speech defect. All I can say is Torah. I heard German rabbis get up and speak for 30 minutes and not quote one Maimar Chazal. This is not for me. And he walked out. Think about it. This is Reb Chaim. Could you imagine to speak for 30 minutes and not quote one Maimar Chazal? This is Reb Chaim. He walked out. The Rav cautioned us when we went into the rabbinate. If you give a drasha and don't quote Maimar Chazal, you're no different than a conservative rabbi or a reform rabbi. What are you speaking about? I can say edut on myself. I'm not. I hope you won't take it as a boast, but I have never spoken in public without quoting Torah Shabbat Peh, a Maimar Chazal, a Rambam. The words of my Rebbe ring in this ear. I hope I'm hearing you 50 years from now emulating us. So that's one version, which is absolutely true. The second version, of course, is much more profound and has been written up. And Agudat Yisrael has a hard time hiding the truth here. You see, at this 1912 conference, they began to think about rabbinic power. And the feeling was that we have to give the rabbis absolute total power. They're going to run the organization. They're responsible for the Torah. They're responsible to God. They're the ones that will lead us properly. And they're starting to formulate the concept of Das Torah, which in one simple word translates to infallibility. Reb Chaim got very upset. And Reb Chaim, they asked him, why are you so upset? We want to give power to the rabbis. Why are you so upset? And Netanel, Reb Chaim gave an answer that you should never forget. Always think about this. If you're a thinking Torah Jew, Reb Chaim said, they just brought electricity to Brisk. Electricity is wonderful compared to the kerosene lamps, but it has one tremendous fault. When the kerosene lamp goes out, all you have to do is refill the oil. All you have to do is go to your neighbor and learn next to his kerosene lamp. All you have to do is go into the Beis Medrash, where they always had kerosene lamps burning for people to learn. When the electricity goes out, the whole town is dark and you have no solution. Rav Chaim said, when a Rav makes a mistake, he makes a mistake. There are other rabbis to go to. We're only human beings. But if you're going to come up with a Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah and their word is authoritative and they're the only ones that have an opinion and they make a mistake, We are all finished. And Reb Chaim could not handle the concept of Das Teira as it was starting to be formulated and developed. It's a powerful mashal. Electricity and a kerosene lamp. Reb Chaim walked away. He never came back, but he couldn't come back because World War I broke out, and as you know, he died towards the end of World War I. Now, there's one other person who attended this conference, and this becomes critically important in the history of Torah. A young man who already had quite a reputation, a graduate of Belushin, a Gaon Adir, a thinker, a poet, a mystical soul, Chassidic origins, Litvish training, broadness, understanding, Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Why did Rav Cook attend? People often ask me this question, what's this? This is Agudat Yisrael. Idiot! This is before Agudat Yisrael. It was a talk of uniting all Jews. All Shomer Shabbos Jews. Creating a tremendous organization which would have outreach and strength and guidance and education and textbooks and newspapers. Revolutionized the world.
Was Rafi invited? Was anybody from the church?
Of course, everyone was invited. Every Torah Jew across the world, including Rabbi Revel, open up Bernard Revel, builder of American Jewish Orthodoxy, and I know the author well, and if he says there that Rabbi Revel was invited, he is telling you a fact. Not a dream. Everyone was invited. Rav Cook went. And then this was only a planning session. They planned for 2 years later, 1914, they would have the opening convention. And they would start the organization and take the bylines and have a constitution. Why did they plan it for 2 years later? Because travel, everything took time. You had to go home. You had to get organized. Communication. No, I still remember when the Talmud wrote me a letter and I had to write an answer till his letter came to me, till my letter came to him. 1 month went by. Today, you guys who know how to type, you go to the computer. It's instantaneous. I write it out. I give it to Sherry. All right, so you get it a day later. Just think. But then travel, plans, committees, mail, 1914. Who left Palestine to attend Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook? The convention never took place. Who can tell me why? World War I broke out. That's how Rav Cook is stuck in Europe. Ephraim, you know Moshe Cohen of Rehov HaTayasim? His grandfather was the Rav of Basel. That's where Rav Cook stayed for his first 2 years. Had no place to go. Where's he going to go? His grandfather had a big home. They were Rav of Basel. Lived nicely. Took Rav Cook in. 1916, a rabbinate opens in London, Machzikei Hadat, and Rav Cook goes to London, where he becomes the Rav of Machzikei Hadat and plays a role with the Balfour Declaration. 1917. 1919, he comes back to Israel. So that solves the problem. People ask, try to understand. The war is over. The problems are worse than ever. The Jews are decimated. 1919, Agudat Yisrael is formally organized. Now, in 1919, they make two tremendous decisions which color Agudat Yisrael history until this very moment, as we sit here, October 31st, 2020. 12. Your name? A Torah Jew does not give a date without thinking 1 year ahead. A Zehu Chacham Haro'eh et Hanolad. The first decision, we are absolutely, totally, completely opposed to the Zionist movement, because there can be no Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel before the advent of Mashiach Tzidkenu. Yeah? You know it or you don't know it. First theological decision. You cannot be a Zionist. If you're a Zionist, if you're a Mizrahiite, if you're a religious Zionist, Shom et Torah and Mitzvah, davening 3 times a day. Remember what I taught you. The ultimate measure of a Jew is et nisht fafelta mincha. Have you ever heard that expression? He never missed davening mincha. Shachris is easy to daven. You wake up in the morning, you daven shachris. You go to sleep at night, you daven marav. Mincha is the hardest prayer. You're running around, particularly when sunset like now is 4:55. In America, where are you? What are you? I forgot a daven mincha. You have to go into a phone booth. You have to daven mincha. People have already written articles to various places where we daven mincha, Moshe. You follow? You never miss a mincha. 3 times a day you daven. Tefillin, Shabbos, Kashrut. Allah Hidurim. You believe that there can be a Jewish state before Mashiach? You're a rotten, vicious, malicious, hideous, handed, toothless, depressed, degenerate, debased, repetitious, malevolent, pushtak and apikoris. A nice path. Cannot be a good Jew, cannot be a member of HaKadosh Yisrael. It's the first decision they make. Now let me tell you in parentheses, let me take you into my world. Brackets. The Rav essentially was a Litvak. The Hasidus, or his feeling for Hasidus, Tanya, Likutei Torah, was icing on the cake. But the cake was a rich chocolate Litvish cake. So one time, you know, in the middle of a Yahrzeit Russia, and the Rav in his prime, it was, if you didn't experience, no one could ever really describe it to you what it was like, 4.5 hours, 5 hours, without a break, halakha, agada, and the whole world, soaring, labriyat, you were in a different world. I remember the shiur began at 8, it ended after 12, and I remember walking out of Lamport Auditorium, it was snowing. We didn't even know it was snowing. We were like on Har Sinai. It was Kabbalah Torah. I remember Rebbe saying in the Agada, he says, again, I'm living it in Yiddish, what can I do? He says, we will come and mach leukes mit the Hasidim, says the zwei kashes, says man darf in second, and say, choder ish ben enfa. When you're fighting with Hasidim, he says, 2 questions you have to ask, and they cannot answer. One was, how do you dare daven shelo bizman? Understand, it's open mishnayit and brachat. The other one was, how do you then not sit in the sukkah and shmini atzeres? It's an open gemara and sukkah. Tachman zayin yeshig hashmini and baruch lo mefarchinon. Go make a break. You have to sit. He says, these questions they can't answer. Close down, and the audience was, you know, having a good laugh, including the chassidim in the audience. Close the brackets. Gentlemen, HaGadosh Israel has never abolished this dogma. Whenever you have a machloket with HaGadosh Israel, and if you read Hachoma from the Eidah Charedit, time and again, they never let HaGadosh Israel forget. You rotten apikrasim. Who gave you permission to sit in the government, to be part of the parliament, to be part of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel? You are going against your own dogma theology and principle, and there's no answer. So whenever you want to knock an aguda out, just ask him this question. He will hem and haw, double talk. He'll put his tail between his legs, if he's honest, and walk away like a silent pussycat. What makes this even worse is the second principle that they adopted. And this principle, of course, is very much with us until today. It's the way Agudat Yisrael functions. Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, the self-perpetuating body. What does it mean, a self-perpetuating body? You have the chief rabbinate of Israel. The chief rabbinate of Israel are, the rabbis are elected. Politicians are involved. Every type of political wheeling and dealing takes place. Who knows what goes on till chief rabbis are elected? Yerushalayim, there's no chief rabbi, not an Ashkenazic one, not a Sephardic one. For years, for decades, we have not had functioning chief rabbi. Right? This is politicians, these are elections. Thank God there's a Knesset every 4 years. There too, it's not. What does self-perpetuating mean? The first group of Rabbanim is by acclamation. No one has to be told who the Gedolei Yisrael are. Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Chaim Isaac Rezhinsky, Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, Rabbi Yisrael Zalman Meltzer, Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Gera Rebbe, the Chatkova Rebbe, the Rishina Rebbeim, the Yekesh Rabbanim, Rav Shlomo Zalman Groya, etc. So the body is formed. Once the body is formed, they select the new members. That's what you call a self-perpetuating body. For the sake of argument, they feel there should always be 13 members of the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. The minute they go down to 11 to 10, they'll co-opt younger people to take the place of those who died. But they will co-opt in their image. This is Lahavdil, exactly our tremendous complaint against the Supreme Court of Israel. It does not represent the people. It represents themselves. This is Ari Deri's famous statement that the Supreme Court represents Talad Amot in Rechavya. And he's absolutely right. The Supreme Court, where do they live? Rechavya, Talbiya, North Tel Aviv, Ramat Aviv. No, that represents the people. And here we emulate American democracy. When it comes to the Supreme Court, we are light years away from the American system, where the politicians had the major role in determining who will be the next member of the Supreme Court. You all know what America's about, Republicans, Democrats, the power a president has, the Congress, the committee that investigates, and here it's self-perpetuating. It's a tremendous issue, and if we believe in democracy, and if we think America is the ultimate democracy, then why don't we learn from their total greatness? But coming back to Agudat Yisrael, this is the Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. It's a fabulous idea. Every rabbi in the pulpit listening to me is praying, Rebbe, why can't you convince my Balabatim? The rabbis are their own bosses. Balabatim cannot boss them around. Balabatim cannot play a role. Politics with the Balabatim, financial considerations, etc., do not enter the picture. It is a self-perpetuating body. Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. But more than that, the Moetzet will be the authorities on all issues. Not just Halacha. Social issues. moral issues, universal issues, financial issues. Al pihem yishak kol davar. And of course, this ultimately gave birth to a new concept that we'll deal with in great, great detail. Bezrat Hashem, Das Torah. And Das Torah, and I'm not going into it now, but I'm just translating it on a popular level, infallibility. The rabbis can't be wrong. The Gedolei Yisrael can't be wrong. As one Agudas wrote in Jewish Observer, their status is slightly less than a bat kol, slightly less than prophecy. This was written by Rabbi Weinberger. I met him. Umgadish rabbi of the young Israel of Williamsburg, once was a real young Israel. Today already it's a different type of young Israel, but he wrote that. I don't know if he regrets it, but whenever I see him, I think of that article in one of the early issues of Jewish Observer. Gentlemen, you can understand that with these concepts, you have a tremendous breach between the Aguda world and what we popularly call the Mizrahi world. Our world is a chasm between us. It is two different cliffs with a very deep sea. How much has been written on these topics? The issue of Jewish sovereignty before the advent of Mashiach is no longer a debate because God willed otherwise. But how can you believe in Das Torah? How can you believe in infallibility if on the most basic issue that has faced the Jewish people since Churban Bayit, Agudat Yisrael was totally, completely, and absolutely wrong with a capital W, and thank God they were wrong, or there'd be no Jewish people today after the Holocaust and after all the assimilation in the great diaspora. God have mercy on us. What would have been if not for the state of Israel? Mori Urebi said more than once that just as the Hasidim say, Hasidus was finally revealed to the world when without it, the Jew would not have survived in greater Poland. They were so downcast, they were so depressed, the Shabtai Tzvi scandal, and all that happened subsequently, and the Chmielnytsky massacres, and God had mercy on us, and the Baal Shem Tov came along. Just as the Hasidim said that, the Rav said, the same thing with the state of Israel. It's not that our generation was better than our generations. Why were we Zaycha? We were not Zaycha. It was HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw without the state of Israel, the Jewish people would not survive. After the Holocaust, after the mass murder, after so many children being born and parents refusing to circumcise them and saying, why should our children be circumcised so they can tell they are Jews? And with all the intermarriage and assimilation, if not for the state of Israel, we would not be here today. Ashreinu shezachinu, that God had mercy on us and gave us the state. It's like Yetziat Mitzrayim, when you fall into Memtet Sharei Tuma, God can't let you fall anymore, or the Jewish people will disappear. Shelo yidach mimenu nidach. God promised us. Look into the Rambam, Hilchot, the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, in Sefer Mitzvot, I believe it's mitzvah Kuf Nun Aleph, if I'm not mistaken, or Kuf Samach Aleph, but look, you'll find it over there, Kuf Nun Dalet, and my mind is jumping back and forth, and you'll see the mitzvah Asay of Kiddush HaChodesh and the magnificent words the Rambam says that God promised us. There will always be a Jewish people.
So how does the Guru respond to that?
You asked, the Eidah Charei did. They're the happiest people in the world that a Guru can't respond because it gives them theology. We are the only good Jews. We are the only honest Jews. We feel there should not be a state. Better, we should be ruled by the Palestinians. And of course, the Eidah Charei did is also more normalized today, but you have the Neturei Kater element. where they go to Arafat Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, where they go to Iran. God have mercy, what you have on the extreme.
So why did they accept government money and
government? Who? The Neturi Kata doesn't accept. They the Haredit, if they some do accept, so they put them in Kherim. Chas v'chalila, they don't accept
government money.
They don't. What? Of course not. The Agudah is part. Agudah today is like Mizrahi.
They don't accept government money for their yeshivas.
Absolutely not. Where are you living?
They pay taxes.
If they work and it shows on the books, they pay taxes. But that they have no choice. If it shows, I don't want to go into the black money floating around. But do you know that as of tomorrow, there's a new law in Israel? Every check that is now going to be printed in the state of Israel automatically will read Lamutav Bilvat. So what does that tell you? Did you know that, Larry? You're an accountant. Beginning with tomorrow, every check, in other words, when you cross a check in Israel, it means you can only deposit it in your account. Until now, they gave you a choice. About 10 years ago, they began. Do you want a check with nothing on it or a check that will say in crosses Lamutav Bilvat? Okay, that's like writing on the back of it in America for deposit only. Beginning with tomorrow, you will no longer have a choice. All checks will say Lamutav Bilvat. You understand what's going on?
They just leave the line blank. People just leave the line blank.
Yeah, all right, you can leave the line.
Give it to someone else.
Absolutely. But ultimately, it shows up in someone's account. You follow?
Oh, how do you trace it?
The government, they trace where it's finally deposited and called the guy in. Hey, $100,000 went into your account. What's it for? Where'd you get it? Why don't you declare it? So he tells the story. This guy gave it to me. They call him the other guy. Where did you save it?
But every check has to go into someone's account.
You can go and cash the check. Cash. You leave it. You can no longer write cash. You follow? You can no longer write cash on a check. Cash. What does cash mean? The bank gives you cash. It doesn't go into anyone's account. You can no longer do that. Lamutav bilvad. Michael, you can't solve every problem, but it's a giant step forward. Gentlemen, let me just one more word set the stage for next week. All right, these were their first two tremendous decisions. Obviously, at this point, Rav Kook can no longer be a member, and that's why people don't understand the difference between 1912, 1914, and what happened after World War I in 1919. For the credit of Agudat Yisrael, I'll only state what I stated a few weeks ago, that after World War I, the Zionist movement became so powerful that Agudah was afraid, not just of Mizrahi, but that the whole movement, which was led by godless people, secularism, everything we spoke about, that it would conquer all the Hasidic youth. So totally opposed, there can't be Jewish sovereignty. The Rabbanim have to guide us in all matters, not just pure halacha, and ultimately that develops into Das Torah. Now, Agudah started planning. And their plan was, we have to do in public what we did, what we wanted to do in 1914. We have to hold an international convention. And they came up with a name for it. It's a name that they use until today, although none of you will see an international convention like this in the immediate future. I actually attended the last one that was, and perhaps it'll be the last one ever for reasons I'll get to, in 1980. They came up with the word Knisya Gedola. It's Talmudic language. Knisya Gedola, in simple Hebrew, translates Kenes Gadol. In American usage, it would be an international convention. And all the effort from 1919, 1920, 21, 22, all the effort as the organization begins to function to plan a tremendous convention for 1923. The city they chose was an enlightened, sophisticated city, a symbol of the fact that Agudah is part of the modern world. It wants to play a role. It's on the map. They chose Vienna. And in 1923, in Vienna, and again, think what Vienna is famous for. It's waltzes, it's chocolate, it's liquor, it's bands, it's Mozart. Vienna, it's like choosing today, I don't know, choosing New York perhaps, Los Angeles, Chicago, Toronto, a world-class city, London. And that's where they hold the first Knesset Gedola in 1923. What happens there? Be'ezrat Hashem, next week. Gentlemen, to reiterate, first of all, thank you, sir. I had some nice comments on yesterday's shiur. It's a fast, wait till you see next week. It's a fascinating topic of husband and wife, two different minhagim, all the different areas that it can affect you. I'll show you from Rav Citron Sutton, the Sutton family, Lundis, wow. What did we do today? Okay, I made some addendums. I finished out Menachem Begin. Don't forget that. Every time Menachem Begin said, Baruch Hashem, and I can tell you, you don't start to understand, in 1977, we were dancing on the streets when Begin became prime minister. We were dancing. And the old-time Rechavya Jews walked by and spat at us in disgust. Anachnu nosim le'atzot ha'brit borchim mikan. They got to get away. We came from America to elect Begin. And they're running away because Begin. And Begin it's a paradox, because the man outwardly was such a good Jew. In his own house, there was a zilzul, Torah. The greatest proof is he didn't give his kids religious education. And look what happens to the family 2-3 generations later. God have mercy, what's come out of the family. It's beyond words. But you see, without Torah education, it cannot be perpetuated. But but publicly, Baruch Hashem, that was Menachem Begin. Shas is Shas. We'll come back to Shas. And Shas is one of the greatest success stories on the Israeli scene. I have to tell you with anguish. I'm not happy to say it. And I happen to know, I've dealt with Aryeh Deri on a one-to-one level. I got to tell you, he's a gong. He has a goynish cup. He has a big forehead like Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. And it has a tfisa in 1 second flat. I've dealt with him. I've seen him in action. And I got to tell you, if he comes back and runs in the next election, he's a force to be reckoned with. Amsalin, who's not in my camp, 100%. But it doesn't have a... I hope I'm wrong. I don't think if Derry runs, Amsalin becomes a non-starter. If Derry doesn't run, then Amsalin perhaps with a certain ticket, maybe he can do something. Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi, Rabinovich, the Dorot HaRishonim, the concept, he is credited with being the person who thought up the idea of Yasu Kulam Agud HaChat Lasok Ritzon Kanam, and it engendered in Bad Homburg. 1912, Reb Chaim, the two reasons why Reb Chaim left, I mean that, the one with the German rabbi with 10 rubles is laughable, but after you hear it once, you don't have to think beyond it. But the one of the lights going out, that already is brisk, that is salivation, that is depth. Unbelievable. Okay. Rav Kook, World War I, 1919, no sovereignty, Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah, Das Torah. Watch. I want to give myself musa, and I want to tell you something very sad. And I want to show you how Chazal were right, how you can't judge anyone. You don't know all the facts. In this classroom, about a year and a half ago, two outsiders were sitting in. One was a student I picked up through the website years ago. He's a graduate of TELS, 67, tremendous hatred for TELS. He left high school graduation to get on the plane, go to Israel, join the army, reached the rank of major. and married a B'nai Brak girl, but then he had no education, tells, no college, nothing, and he had to make money, went back to where the usual story, went back for 2 years, wound up spending a lifetime there. And became my Talmud, very good to me, very kind to me, wonderful human being, etc. Another fellow comes into class. This fellow at the time was 58. The other fellow must have been 52, 53. Had been my Talmud in the Kollel, early 80s. He was a rabbi in London. Just came back to Israel. His wife drove him crazy. We can't raise the... got married lady, had young children, a flock of... You can't raise the kids in London, only in Israel. They settled in Beit El. And he's going into the rare book business. So these two fellows have a discussion, and the guy from Florida gives him $300 as a down payment towards his looking up certain books for him. I never saw the book dealer again. I was in Florida last January, and the person who gave him $300 is whining and dining us and says to me, you know, I never heard from Rabbi Dash again. I felt very bad, like he took his $300 and disappeared with it. And I felt bad because, not that I was involved, but it was in my classroom. It's like my Gushpanka was on this meeting. Okay. A fellow from Florida committed suicide, as you know, last March, Lower Lane. Still pains me. And I always thought to myself, well, he went down to the grave and someone owes him $300. I always felt bad. Every week living in Israel, every day we get the free papers here. Not like New York, they give you a little paper, 2 pages. Here you get a real newspaper brought down, Olmert, Adelson, Yisrael Hayom. Friday you get 2 real thick newspapers, one Basheva, which is my world, the Tzioni.t, right-wing world, with all the news that I wish would be. And the other one is Hashavua from the Haredi world, where it's amazing how many non-truths you can put into so few pages. It's beyond words, because I know the facts, and it's under censorship. But they now have a glossy magazine. And I take a look, an article on this book dealer, my Talmud, his life. And I look, Rabbi Yaakov Shmayahu, Zichrono Livracha. I read the article. He came in Aliyah, came to my class. A few weeks later was Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, right after Yom Kippur. Died in 1 second, what they call an embolism. That's what they think it is, heart trouble. Look how I thought he had taken the money and ran with it. He pushed it, died. No one knew. No one knew his business. It was in his head. He was just beginning. You follow me? Chol Hamoed Sukkos, I was at the King David Hotel. I was being entertained by him. People from YU, good people, Board of Trustees members. As I'm walking out, I meet people coming in to take the wealthy people to communities to show them around, and one of them is taking them to Bethel. I know this guy. I say to him, Yehuda, Yaakov Shmayahu, what happened? And he tells me he died last month, so Yom Kippur 7. I said, why didn't you publicize it? No one knew. Griscolo. As far as I know, no one knew. There was no ad, nothing. He says, well, he was new to the community. No one knew him. He was only here a few months. And it was Matzor Yom Kippur. Everyone's getting ready for Sukkot. By the time we looked up, it was all over, ancient history. Boy, did I learn a lesson from this. Al tadin et charcha, atzor degil makomo, hebi dun et kol adam lekach schut. And if I had any bad thought on Rabbi Yaakov Shmayahu, I ask his forgiveness. I didn't know. I feel very bad. If anyone wants it, it's a fascinating article. Secondly, I want to say to you, Every week I see you sign up about Shabbos Torah Shraga, evidently puts it up, or the Kollel, and someone writes, have an amazing Shabbos. I would like to know, what does that mean, have an amazing Shabbos? It takes me back to when I learned in Lakewood, and I'm spending a Shabbos there, and it was a normal Shabbos Kiddush. And I, a young kid with a big mouth, I complained, where's the Chassidus, where's their singing? They wiped the floor with me. We learn all week around the clock. We're dead tired on Shabbos. What do you want? This is not a Hasidic shtibble. It's not like Hasidim who don't open up a sefer. We can Shabbos. They go to the Rebbe and they sing. So I want to understand, if anyone will explain to me, what is an amazing Shabbos? To me, an amazing Shabbos is you daven early, you come home, you learn for 3-4 hours, no interruptions. That's an amazing Shabbos. Next, Kosher Tube, the story of the Rebbe's picture in my office. It's a magnificent picture, I'll tell you why. Story was told to me by the person who took it, Rabbi David Alstrick. Am I pronouncing his name right?
Kapel-Goldberg.
Who took the picture?
Kapel-Goldberg.
So why do I have Kosher Tube? Why do I have this name?
I have no idea. David Alstrick runs Kosher Tube.
And
he runs Kosher Tube. He taped your shear in Toronto.
Right. And who gave me the picture? Wasn't it?
Kapel Goldberg.
Spell Kapel.
K-O-P-E-L.
And what did Kapel Goldberg, did he have anything
to... doctor.
Did he have anything to do with David Alstrika?
No, he was just at the shear because he's friends with us. And I told him, you got to come here, the Rebbe's shear.
Okay. Anyway, this individual, he evidently... as a kumana to Chabad.
Yeah.
Okay, so he was a photographer and he was picked up by Hasidus and he went to this Fabrengen and he's trying to take a picture of the Rebbe and he's focusing the camera. It's long before these magic cameras of today. And the Rebbe suddenly turns to him and says, Nu, mach shena bil, make a picture already. And he snapped the Rebbe as he said it. What's fabulous about this picture is in the background, and it's not clear. It's what would be the word where you don't see clearly thousands of chassidim, but the Rebbe you see very clearly, and it's the Rebbe with thousands out there. He's talking to one individual. It's a magnificent picture. I hold it to be one of the greatest pictures I've ever seen of any Rav or Rebbe. It captures the world. So you say it's Dr. Kapel Goldberg. So I had an Erev HaPashiyot between the two. Finally, I was involved in this case. I couldn't get anywhere. It's a child of students of mine. Are you aware that someone who works for the United States government on Capitol Hill was just declared in serum? He's in nidui. He refuses to give his wife a get. Are you aware of this case? It comes out of Baltimore, and it's an interesting story. Will this help? Will it accomplish anything? Should the senator or the congressman he works for, should he fire him? What a difficult situation. Friedman Epstein marriage, and to go public all over the world. And everyone is tuned in to their heartache. If anyone wants one of these svarim, it's yours if you want to use it. Once again, if you have to give a drasha, this is all HaTorah by Rav Mordechai Kohn. Very beautiful vetlach on Kol HaTorah Kula. This is the rush on Gittin, the rush on Nashim, and Rabbi Shurkin Sr. on Baba Kama. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Tas Vedanya. Thank you very, very much.